organized by the Information Systems and Innovation Group of the Department of Management of the London School of Economics with the British Computer Society. It's the first time we partnered together to organize a lecture, and we hope that we will be able to come together again in the future for similar events and lectures. We have a lot of in common. But I'm very happy that today's lecture has a very interesting topic and a very well-known speaker, Bruce Schneier, who is a security technologist, a very creative one, who uses both old technologies and new technologies to spread ideas and messages. And although he is a technologist, very appropriately for the London School of Economics, he chose the topic of economic trends that are implicated in security. And I'm very, very curious to hear what he has to say. I see in the audience here people who were in the social study of IT workshop that we ran the last couple of days. And so some of you heard him on Monday too, but today it's a different topic, and I don't want to delay. Please, Bruce, if you can come and start. We will have a lecture of about an hour, and then we will have half an hour time for questions, if there are questions and comments.
Thank you. It's actually pretty stupid to come here to talk about economics, if you think about it. I'm not an economist, I just pretend, and it's usually easier to pretend if people know less than I do about economics. So I'll see how this goes. Actually, there is a new and vibrant research speciality in economics and computer security. There's a conference called WICE, the Workshop on Economics and Information Security. I believe we've had six so far. The next one will be at Carnegie Mellon in a couple of months. And I really do urge anyone who's interested in the confluence of computer security and economics to look at the websites, download the papers, and start reading some of this stuff. There's a lot of really interesting work being done on economics and computer security. And as I'm going to try to demonstrate here, economics really is a really useful tool for shining a light on some computer security questions that, you know, from our point of view, from the tech point of view, just make no sense. And the answers are economic answers. So this sort of two parts of this talk. I'm going to list 10 trends in computer security, 10 things that are happening right now that I think are important. There's some older, some newer, and some near future trends. Although when you look at, when you hear me talking about them, think about economics. Think about the economic motivators underlying the things we're talking about. And then I'll start trying to pull those together. So here are the 10 trends, and I'll put them up there so there are no surprises. The first one is the economic value of information. Right? This is somewhat old, yet it's also new. Corporations have recognized that information has economic value. Right? We're at the point now where there are companies where their information assets are worth more than their physical assets. And this isn't even surprising. Right? This is perceived as normal. So there's a huge amount of corporate assets in information. Also, information about us has value. It has value in process streamlining and convenience. Right? I like it when, Amazon.com one click, a really easy service where I can very quickly buy a book that is driven by a back-end database that has my credit card details. Right? The information has a lot of value in process streamlining, and that is good for customer retention. Also in marketing, the obvious one I think is personalization. I also like it when Amazon.com, when I log in, presents me with books that I might want to buy based on books I've already bought. That is an incredibly valuable service to me. I regularly learn about books that I want and I buy that I didn't know existed. And that also is driven by a personal database of the books I bought. And actually, Amazon keeps a database of the books I bought, as well as the books I looked at and chose not to buy. Right? This has value in control. In any login system, any security system on the net, it's going to be based on some kind of password, some kind of database of information that's verified against when I try to log in. And of course, there's value for law enforcement, for forensic value. Lots of times the police have gone into databases and looked for evidence, whether it's search databases, whether it's databases of phone calls. Right? I mean, this has value. You know, and information is an enormous asset. In the dot-com bust around the year 2000, there were companies in the U.S., when they went under, their database was their only saleable asset, which in some ways is surprising. Yet, it's perfectly reasonable. So, the information has enormous economic value. And I think that's an important trend. And it drives a lot of it. I mean, it's really why computer security exists. If information didn't have value, we'd all be hobbyists. And no one would ever hire us. And we are hired because there's real value here. Another trend is networks as critical infrastructure. Right? And this is also new. In the early days of the net, we would all talk about Star Trek. It was important you'd get it in the mail. When was the last time you got something important in the mail? These days, if it's important, you get it over the internet. Right? If it's unimportant, it comes in the mail. That's really reversed. More and more information drives our infrastructure. There are companies who would go out of business if the internet disappeared. And it's not only, I mean, there are obvious companies like Amazon, eBay, but other companies too. I mean, their order system is based on the internet. And these are small. What always surprises me is not the large companies, but the small companies. The 10-person, the mom-and-pop design shops, that without the internet, they can't do business. That's how they get their orders. That's how they deliver their products. And the internet is required for them to work. But also, you think about communications companies, transportation companies, all the paperwork moves over the net, manufacturing companies. Again, the same thing. And we saw this in 2004, the blackout in the United States over much of the Northeast was a really good example and taught companies how much they depended on the internet. And they just stopped. And they didn't expect it, and they did. So networks as critical infrastructure, I think, is an important trend. The third trend is about your information. Your information isn't controlled by you. And I tell people this, sometimes they're surprised. Sometimes they say, well, I guess I haven't thought of that. But it's true. Your information is no longer under your control. It used to be it was yours. Right? I mean, legal protections about your information are generally written in terms of your person, your home, your car. That your information is under your direct control. That's no longer true. Right? My email is right now sitting at my ISP waiting for me to download it. If you use Google or Hotmail or any of those, you know, Gmail or Hotmail, you never download your email. Right? They control it completely. Your online merchants, I'm talking about Amazon, they know the things you buy, eBay the same thing. Your medical records are at a hospital in the UK. There's a large database where they're all being stored. Your credit reports, right, the list of things, of places you make purchases. Your phone records. And who you call. You remember a couple of years ago, Paris Hilton's cell phone got hacked. And on the web, we got her phone book and a bunch of SMS messages. The thing about that story is her phone didn't get hacked. She did nothing wrong. Someone hacked T-Mobile and grabbed her information. And even though her information was on her phone, it was also somewhere else. She didn't control it. Right. T-Mobile controlled it and decided to also put a copy on her phone. So all this information about you is no longer under your direct control. At BT Counterpane, we use a program called Salesforce.com. It's kind of a sales leads automation tool, but it basically involves us putting all the information about our sales leads on some corporate website. Now, we get lots of guarantees that they're going to keep it secure, but it's still no longer under our direct control. And I think that's real important. double-sided?
Trend four. Criminals are now the dominant attacker on the net. Right? It used to be attackers were hobbyists. If I was giving a talk on computer security, as early as 7 years ago, I would talk about defacing web pages. Right? That's what the bad guys did. It's almost quaint today. Right? Today, the bad guys steal your money. It's very different. Hacking has changed from a hobbyist pursuit to a criminal pursuit. Okay, there are lots of ways to make money criminally on the net. Identity theft is the big one, which is fraud due to impersonation. There's also spam. There's a business model in spam. Denial of service extortion. You see more and more of that. Okay, there's a market for zero-day exploits. There's a market for botnet. There's real money to be made. And a lot of this we're seeing from loan criminals and also moving up to organized crime. There's more and more criminals. And they'll come from Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Eastern Europe, South America. I mean, it's very international, and it is a big business. And I saw a statistic recently that said that the amount of money in identity theft in the U.S. is greater than the amount of money in drugs. I have no idea if that's true. It's kind of a wacky statistic. But it gives you some idea of the magnitude of the amount of money being stolen. It is that big. So criminals, I think, are a really important trend. And they're not going away. We're not going to solve this. The fifth one is complexity. I've given hour-long talks on that, so I'm going to really quickly summarize. Complexity is the worst enemy of security. One of the questions to ask is, in computers, we're used to things getting better, right? Computers get faster, there's more memory, and whether it's, music playing or word processing or graphics, you wait a generation and it gets better, faster, cheaper. Why is computer security getting worse? Right? Shouldn't it get better, faster, cheaper? The reason is complexity. Right? Every version of everything is significantly more complex than the previous. Right? Whether it's the microprocessor, the operating system, the application software. Right? Complexity, we love complexity. It lets us do cool things. So computer security, this is why I picture it. Computer security is getting better, right? Just like everything else. But complexity is getting worse faster. So we lose ground even as we are improving. And this also isn't going away. I mean, if I told you, if you want a secure computer, use DOS. Right? Regardless of whether that's true, you're not going to do it. Right? I'm not going to do it. We like complexity. But with complexity, we get insecurity. Life is like that. Right? It just makes our job harder. The sixth trend is kind of a pair of them. And it's about patching. Patching is there's a really weird business model in computers. It's a model of we build a thing, we don't know if it's any good, we throw it out there, and if it's no good, we fix it later. That's the business model. That's the business model of patching. That instead of doing it right, we're going to just sort of do it, and we'll fix it later. Patching is hard. And here's the basic problem in patching. You want to send out a patch as quickly as possible. Years ago, I wrote an essay where I defined something called a window of exposure. And it's the period between when the vulnerability is public and when you've applied the patch, right? The window in which you're vulnerable. You want to make that as small as possible. You want your vendor to produce a patch within hours, minutes, days at the most. Right? Every second is precious here. At the same time, the patch must be extraordinarily well tested. Right? It must be tested in every possible configuration out there. But you've got to download it, install it, and it's got to work. Those two things are possible at the same time. Right? You can have it well tested, or you can have it fast. You can't have both. And a couple of years ago, Microsoft decided, I think this was a really smart decision. They were having the problem of unreliable patches. People wouldn't install their patches because they weren't very good. So they decided they're going to batch their patches to the first Tuesday every month. It's called Patch Tuesday. And you download them and install them. This has worked very well, actually. The patches are now much more reliable. and there's a far greater take rate. More people are turning on the automatic patching systems. More people are installing their patches. Right? But this is a problem. And you'll see new vulnerabilities come out the day of Patch Tuesday. Right? So the bad guy maximizes the window. I mean, so they're not optimizing too. And we are seeing faster exploits. Right? It used to take months between when a vulnerability appeared and when there was a worm. Now it's days. Zotab was 5 days. Right? There are more zero-day exploits where they happen at the same time. That's a trend. Another trend is the sophistication of automatic worms. And this thing is really interesting. The worms we're seeing today are far more sophisticated than they were 3-5 years ago. Polymorphic worms, metamorphic worms, worms that employ entry point obfuscation. We see worms that use Google as a vulnerability assessment tool. We see targeted worms against certain companies, certain industries, certain people. We see worms that are much better written. Right? The notion of a blended threat, malicious code plus a vulnerability, is new. We see worms that are quieter. Like the old worms, when they would infect you, they'd put a funny message on your screen. The new worms don't do that. They don't advertise their presence. We see worms that will infect a computer and then report back to their owner asking for instructions. Or worms that will smartly figure out what to do. Should we sniff passwords? Should we use this as a launching pad for further infections? Should we just harvest this computer into a bot network? Right? They're making smart decisions. And I think this is also an effect of the fact that criminals are writing them more. Right? When you write a worm as a hacker, you look at the score style points. When you're writing a worm as a criminal, you just want it to be effective. I think it's another reason you see more worm variants. If you look at some of the new worms, Netsky, for example, there will be 20, 30 different variants of them. Right? If you're a hacker, you've got to do it new. If you're a criminal, you keep doing the same things. Make minor modifications, different payload, different attack vector, but basically the same worm. We see a lot more of those. Trend 8 is about the endpoints. A lot of computer security is built on the premise that you can trust the endpoints. Right? For example, think of PGP, email security. Right? I'll type my email on my computer, encrypt it, send it to you, you decrypt it and read it. Right, for that model to work, my computer and your computer has to be trusted. And when you think of most of the computer security mechanisms, email security, SSL, SSH, the things that protect the web, they're all based on this model. The model fails. Right? The model doesn't work. And today's attackers tend to use things like Trojans or spyware. They attack the endpoints. I mean, it doesn't matter how good your encryption is if the bad guy reads your email by capturing your keyboard stream, or by peeking into video memory, or by looking at the file after you decrypt it, before you read it. I mean, all this talk about two-factor authentication, none of it matters if the bad guy is controlling your computer and sending fraudulent transactions in the background after you've authenticated. And a lot of our security is built on the model that the endpoints are trusted, but in fact they're not. And we are seeing this come into play. In the US, there have been laws mandating two-factor authentication for banks. That it's no longer password, it must be password plus something else. And what I wrote about, what I predicted, is I said, this is not going to fix the problem of identity theft. All it'll do is force the bad guys to change their tactics. And that's what's happening. They're going after the endpoints. The endpoints are hard. This is where Microsoft is spending a lot of effort on operating system security. They're trying to deal with this problem. It's a tough one. It's not going away anytime soon. But it really affects what the bad guys do. Trend 9 is similar. I mean, this trend 9 is about the end user as the attacker. You know, traditional security protects you from the bad guys. There's a branch of security that protects someone else from you. And the obvious example of that is digital rights management, copy protection. Right? The whole point of copy protection is for someone to force you to put something in a computer that you don't want, that reduces your functionality, that pisses you off, right, and make it so you can't delete it. This sounds a whole lot like a hacking tool, doesn't it? That's what it is. Right, you know, more and more we are seeing security being forced on us by media companies, by operating system vendors and who's media companies. A lot of it looks like malicious code. And there was a huge scandal with Sony about a year ago where they basically put a rootkit on people's computers without their permission in an effort to stop them copying music. Now, and we're going to see a lot more of this. This is a very important trend because to a very real extent, as a security expert, I can't do both things. I can't protect you and at the same time protect from you. I've got to do one or the other. And as I protect you, I'm going to make it harder for Sony to keep you from copying music. And as I do what Sony wants and keep you from copying music, I have a hard time protecting you from the bad guys. And I can't do both. They're in opposition. But then there's an enormous legal battle brewing here, which I guess is ongoing, which will continue to go. Right? As we're going to get more and more invasive tools to basically assume we are the bad guy and we are the attacker and try to limit how we can use our computers. And this is happening actually in all over the world, in pretty much every industrialized country. The tenth trend is regulation. Regulation, I think, is real. You know, as someone who's run a security company, it's actually really hard to get people to buy security. Right? There are two basic ways of selling something: fear and greed. Greed is the better one. Fear is the hard one. Security has always been a fear sell. It's like selling insurance. Right? Buy this thing, or the bad stuff will happen to you. Which the obvious reaction is, well, you know, the bad stuff didn't happen to me last year and it didn't happen to stuff, so maybe I'll be lucky next year. And, you know, often you'll see security companies try slogans like, you know, we help you do your business, or, you know, we make it so you can do all these cool stuff. That's an attempt to turn it into a greed sell. It basically never works. And security is fundamentally a fear sell. It turns out that the one thing that has worked is regulation. That fear of failing an audit, right, fear of being in non-compliance, fear of breaking the law, is way bigger than fear of data theft or, you know, your computer's going down or any security thing. It annoys me to no end, but sort of there you have it. And there have been a bunch of regulations in the past few years that I think have really made a big difference in the security industry. In the United States, which is what I know best, the big one is Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean, you guys have the European Data Protection Act, which you've had for a while. But there are also laws about healthcare data. There's something called PCI, which is a security standard. It's a private one. Visa, MasterCard have developed it and are forcing their merchants to follow it. And so it's not just government standards, it's also private standards. But, I mean, these regulations, I think, are a big deal. And they really are now driving the security market. So what does this all mean? I mean, when you stare at this stuff, you know, you're trying to pull some common threads. I mean, to me, it means things are getting worse and not better. It definitely means they're getting more complicated. It also means, as we go through these, the non-technical aspects of security matter a lot more than the technical aspects. This is no longer about technology. It's about getting people to use technology. It's about getting it implemented, having it work properly. The future, I think, is getting hard to predict. I mean, it's not at all obvious what's going to happen, which way this will go. And really, that I think the important driver is economics and not computer science. Right, so here are some economic principles of IT. Stop touching that. Here's some economic principles of IT. The first one is the notion of network effects. In computer science, something famous called Metcalfe's law. The value of a network is the square of the number of users. A real important point. This holds true for real networks, right? For the obvious ones, phones, faxes, email. Right? Your phone is more valuable than more people who also have a telephone. Right? That's obvious. If you're the first one with a phone, it has no value at all. When two people have a phone, they can talk to each other. When a million people have a phone, we can all talk to each other. Right? It's true for, it's also true for virtual networks. Right? The network of Windows users, of Mac users. Right? The more people who use an operating system, the more value it has for all of us. Right? The more software there is for it, the more support there is for it, the more it's updated, the more there's a critical mass at which the product takes on a life of its own and it has more value. So what that tends to mean is you tend to have markets with a dominant player, right? Because the big tend to get bigger. Right? And in standards, you tend to have one that wins. Right? There is one fax standard. In the beginning, there were several. Right? There is one email standard. There is basically one operating system. There are only a few, very few, word processing standards. So we can send files back and forth. Right? And even when there aren't, you've got to be compatible. Right? You've got to be within the standard. The second one is that software tends to have high fixed costs and low marginal costs. Right? The first one is expensive, everything else is free. Several industries have this characteristic. Pharmaceuticals is one. Right? But what this means is that without sort of left unfettered, competition can drive prices down to zero, right? To the marginal cost of production, to very cheap. Which means in these markets, you have to sort of build in these anti-capitalist defenses to protect companies so they can recover their fixed costs. Right? These are patents, copyrights, compatibilities, right? Proprietary accessories, right? Different ways to try to lock people in. Right? Which gets to number three, the notion of high switching costs. It can be very expensive to switch from one product to another. Right, some markets, it's easy. Right, for me to switch another brand of bottled water takes no effort. For me to switch to another email reader can be very difficult. I have to learn a whole new system. I need to convert all my existing files. I need to make sure it's compatible with everything else I do. If I had any custom apps, any custom things I've written, I need to rewrite them. Right, if I'm a company who has retraining staff, converting it, boy, it's huge. And so lock-in's a big deal. And companies try to increase their lock-in. There's it's called the Shapiro variance theorem. It says where the net present value of a software company equals the total switching costs. To me it's really interesting. It explains a lot about why so much effort goes into accessory control. Why all of the game manufacturers make sure that nobody else writes games for their platform. That you can't take your cartridges from one platform and move them to the other. Right there. That's trying to control lock-in to make it harder. Right? Printers and cartridges, the same thing. Right? It's all about lock-in. And these two also tend to lead to a dominant market structure. Right? In fact, all three do. But you tend to get a market where one firm dominates. The fourth trend, and I think this is very applicable to security, is, how do I describe it? There's certain kinds of markets where the seller of the product knows a lot more about it than the buyer. Right? Software is an example of that. Security software is an example of that. There's a paper by an economist called Akerlof. And it's called a market for lemons. And what he writes about is this type of market. An example he uses is a used car market. In the U.S., lemon is a bad used car. Right? It's a piece of junk that you don't know is bad. And he writes about a market where there are, and I'm going to make this up, 1,000 used cars for sale, right? 500 good cars for £2,000 each, and 500 lemons for £1,000 each. Right. And the buyers can't tell the difference between the good cars and the lemons. In that market, the equilibrium price is $1,500. And with that equilibrium price, no good cars sell and only lemons sell. Right? When the seller knows more about the product than the buyer, The buyer can't make an informed buying decision, and that drives good products out of the market. Right? The bad drives good products out of the market. You see it in security. I can hold up two products. They do, I don't know, email encryption. And they'll use the same algorithms, have the same buzzwords, they'll make the same security claims. You can't tell the difference. Right? One is very well designed. One is cheaply designed. The well-designed one is more expensive. Which one are you going to buy? You're going to buy the cheaper one because you can't tell the difference. And you see this a lot. I mean, this to me is why in the firewall market, all the leading products are mediocre ones in the IDS market. And the good products tend to get driven out of the market because people tend to buy the mediocre ones because they don't know the difference. So let's talk about economics as a security driver. I tend to write about security as a trade-off. Right? You're getting something and you're giving something else up. And you're getting some security and you're paying in money and convenience and something. Right? You're balancing the costs and benefits. And there's a cost to security failures. Right? You lose money. I mentioned regulatory non-compliance, theft of information. You know, if you're a company that's bad press, maybe you lose customers. Right? There are real costs to bad security. There are also costs to security. Right? Security costs money. Security costs convenience for your employees, for your customers. Maybe it needs fewer features. Right? If you're a bank, you can't offer the kinds of online banking you might want to do. If you're a software company, you can't have as many features as you might want. Maybe you know, slower time to market, less functionality. Right? There are real costs to security. Any smart company is going to make a trade-off. Like the costs have to balance the benefits. Right? And more security is makes no sense economically, as does less security. There's going to be some kind of sweet spot. And when you think about that, security failures are basically economic failures. Right? It's people getting the trade-offs wrong. And they get it wrong for a whole bunch of reasons, right? It is a poor understanding of the risks. And this is very common in computer security. I mean, it's very hard to understand the risks. They're technological, which makes them hard to grasp. The media tends to be confused about them all the time. I mean, the stuff they write about almost barely matches reality. There's not a lot of real data on the risks. I mean, there's a lot of data on, for example, street crime. It's really easy to get the data. It's much harder to get the data on computer attacks and damages. And there's a certain kind of risk that's hard to deal with, and computer risks tend to be this way. Normal risk evaluation is based on something called annualized loss expectancy. And it's pretty easy. You take the percent chance you'll be whacked in a year, multiply by the amount of damage if you are whacked, and that tells you how much you should spend for a year on security. Right? If you'll lose $1,000 if you're mugged, and there's a 1 in 10 chance you'll be mugged, you should spend $100 on anti-mugging security. Right? You spend more than that, you're wasting money. You spend less than that, you're wasting money. Right? That's a really easy model. That model fails when you have an event that is very, very rare, right, where the probability drops to zero, and the damage approaches infinity. Because when you multiply zero by infinity, you get basically every number. This is why counterterrorism defenses are very hard to grasp, because they have these characteristics, same characteristics. Very rare, very, very damaging. And also why if you buy stuff from a security company and you ask for a cost justification, whatever they give you is not going to make any sense. Because when you have this kind of characteristic, you can make the product be whatever you want. Right? I can produce a cost justification for anything just by jiggering these numbers a little bit. Right? That makes it real hard to get a numeric grasp on the risk. So people get the trade-offs wrong. Also, they get the trade-offs wrong because they have a poor understanding of the costs. It's really hard to grasp what the costs of security versus non-security are. A lot of the costs are hidden, they're soft, they're PR costs. What's the cost of the bad press? It's really hard to know. And also, there are externalities. And this is sort of,
I guess for the economists here, this is a term you all know. But for computer security people, something you have to go through, you know, in minute detail. A lot of security, I mean, a lot of the security trade-offs fail because of externalities. All right, so I'm going to give a little quick externality tutorial. An externality is basically an effect of a decision not borne by the decision maker. An easy example, I'll give you an environmental example. We have a power plant, we pollute the river, people downstream die, we don't live downstream, we don't care. Right, easy externality. The effects of us polluting the river isn't borne by us, so we don't take it into account. You see this a lot in security. In the U.S., we're getting new currency. Right? We're getting new bills with more anti-counterfeiting features, because counterfeiters are just getting better. And one of the things people wonder is why there isn't a massive public education campaign in how to detect counterfeit money. But the reason there isn't is the externality. But it is not in your best interest to find counterfeit money in your wallet. If I tell you how to do it, you won't look. Actually, you probably will look, but if you find one, you'll, you know, spend it anyway. But you don't want to know. Right? You know, spending money educating you on how to detect counterfeiting doesn't help because the losses due to counterfeiting are largely an externality to you. They're important to the government, but not to you. And a lot of security paradoxes can be explained by looking at externalities. Maybe look at cell phone companies who spend enormous amounts of money on the security problem of toll fraud and absolutely zero money on the problem of voice privacy. Like, voice privacy is an externality. It's not something they notice, not something they care about. And a lot of failures in security are externality failures. In the U.S., we are having enormous problems with data thefts. Right? Personal data is being stolen out of databases, I mean, left and right, and so common it's no longer news. I mean, why aren't companies securing our data, my data, better? Because it's an externality. I mean, they don't feel the pain when my data gets stolen. I do. And often it's data brokers. I don't even have a business relationship with them. I can't even fire them and hire somebody else. Right? And that's an externality. Infrastructure and terrorism risks is sort of the same thing. Right? The losses are much broader to society, so individual companies, we're having a problem in the U.S. with getting companies to secure their chemical plants. Right? Most of the risk is an externality. It's bigger than the company. So of course they're not going to pay for it. I mean, they're not a charity. But it's the same thing with buggy software, I mean, especially if there's a monopoly involved, or insecure home computers. I mean, we're living in a world where the security of you, me, and all of us depends on lots of home computer users. My mother, right? The security of the London School of Economics, their networks, depends on my mother. And honestly, my mother couldn't care less. Right? She's going to download whatever she wants to download. She's going to get viruses and Trojans on her computer. They'll be used in bot networks to attack you. You know, she doesn't care. I come home, I clean out her computer about once or twice a year, but that's it. This is a problem. It's an externality. We can't expect my mother to care. I mean, she just wants to be able to send me an email and go shopping on the net, read the news. That's what matters. Everything else is an externality. Right? So how do you do that? How do you manage this? Well, this is just a basic economics. Right? You modify the cost-benefit trade-off. Right? Go back to the environmental example. How do you make the company care that they're polluting the river and people downstream are dying? Well, you have one of two ways. One, you pass a regulation saying if you pollute the river, you'll go to jail. Right? The two is you allow the people downstream to sue. Right? Both of which raise the cost of doing the bad thing, which will incent companies to put, you know, whatever scrubbers are required. Right? Which one you pick, right, depends on your politics. I actually don't care. Right? But what I need as a security expert, as a security guy, is to get those externalities internal. Right? To make it so my mother cares that her computer is secure, that it's not affected by a Trojan or a bot, that it's not being used to attack other people's computers. Or if I can't make her care, I'll make her ISP care. And I make someone care, because otherwise it'll never get fixed. Right? I mean, and you'll see, you know, laws affect externalities all the time. You know, a great example is credit card fraud. In the U.S. in the 70s, and you want to say in wisdom, but it's probably nothing but accident, and the U.S. government passed a very interesting law. It said that if there is credit card fraud, no matter who's at fault, the customer can only be out a maximum of $50. Now, this means if I take my credit card, fling it into the room, plus give you a copy of my signature, I'm out $50 max. I mean, that's the, no matter how negligent I am with my credit card, my maximum liability is $50. The credit company is on the hook for everything else. And what that did is, that forced the credit card companies to invent all sorts of security mechanisms. And if you think about the history of credit card security, a bunch of years ago, some of you might remember, there would be these books that merchants would get of bad credit card numbers. And they would look up your number in the book and see if it was there. If it wasn't there, they'd know the number, your credit card was good. Now, that was replaced with online verification, right? Real-time terminals that will verify credit card numbers. We have expert systems that work in the background and automatically detect credit card fraud. I use a credit card all the time. I travel a lot. I use a credit card in 4 countries in 1 day. Some of them, you know, shady Eastern European countries. I was in Canada last summer at a restaurant. Someone basically swiped my number. They got the card back. In 2 purchases, the card company turned my card off. I have no idea how they did that. But that's impressive. And that's an expert system sitting in the background looking for fraudulent spending patterns. Right? There are mechanisms now for card activation where a card and a PIN are sent separately. You know, all of these security measures were put in place because the credit card companies were on the hook for the losses. Right? If you were on the hook, that would never have happened. And I think we need that same model for personal information disclosure, for software vendors. Right, the basic idea, I mean, what I think is the meta way to think of this is we need to align interests and capabilities. Right, the organization with the ability to mitigate the risk needs to be responsible for the risk. Right, for the credit card risk, I couldn't solve the problem. As the cardholder, all I can do is protect my card. I can't protect the number, I can't protect anything else. So it makes no sense for me to own the risk. It's got to be owned by the credit card company. And you see this battle now with the online brokerage accounts. Right? Yeah, I don't have one, but if I had one, right, I'd be trading online, trading stocks. And you know, this happens, you go on, and suddenly all your money's gone. And you pick up the phone and you call your broker and say, what happened? And they say, well, you know, your password was used to withdraw the money, so it's not our fault. What do you mean it's not our fault? Your fault? Whose fault is it? I wasn't involved. I'm not here. I'm in no position to mitigate the risk. You have to. And so they need to be responsible for it. I'll give you my favorite example of this. I don't know if you have this in here in the UK. If you have this in the US, it's actually very common. At some sort of low-end merchants, you'll see a sign on the cash register that says, your purchase free if you don't get a receipt. Does this sound familiar? This is actually a very clever security device. Let's talk about it. If you are a... one of the problems with merchants and stores is employee theft. Right? Employees stealing money out of the till. And in fact, the history of the cash register is a history of this very problem. Right? Early cash registers were simply a cash drawer with a bell. And the bell would alert the owner of the store that someone had opened the drawer. Right? Later developments were a register tape, and that's basically an audit trail. And what you would do as a merchant is you would compare the amount of money in the drawer with the amount of money the register tape says is in the drawer, and any difference you'd dock the employee's pay for the difference. I don't know if you'd give the employee the surplus if there was any, but you'd dock their pay. And that's been the method of choice for protecting against employee fraud. So now if you are a crooked employee, you
want to get a transaction off the register. Right? If you can sell something and not ring it up, you can pocket the money. And in fact, that is a very common method of employee theft. Right? So now, as a merchant, what do? Okay, so here's a good place. You could stand and watch the employee. But if you do that, you know, why have the employee? That's silly. So here's what you're going to do. There's someone else involved in this transaction. The customer. But the problem is, the customer doesn't care. This is an externality to the customer whether the merchant, the employee steals the merchant. He doesn't care. He just wants whatever he's buying. So what the merchant's going to do is he's going to hire the customer as a security guard. He's going to put a sign on the register saying, your purchase here, you don't get a receipt. And what that will do, now the customer cares whether he gets a receipt or not. And he will watch it and make sure he gets a receipt. And actually, the sort of mechanism is the employee now wants to give the customer a receipt. The same basic idea. Right? We are turning the customer from a disinterested third party into a security guard just by putting that sign up. Right, you saw a very similar thing happen in Italy a few years ago. In Italy, tax fraud is kind of a national hobby. And one of after years of trying to pass laws forcing merchants to give official receipts, the city of Rome had a really clever idea. They passed a law saying that any customer caught within 100 meters of a store having just purchased something without a receipt will be fined. Now the customers are demanding receipts. That law was actually rescinded a couple of years later because it confused the tourists. Right? A better idea was tried in Taiwan, where official receipts are also lottery tickets. So with your receipt, you get a number, which is an entry into a lottery. Right? I think it's a better way of doing it. Right? Because now customers are all demanding receipts because they want their lottery ticket. Same basic idea. Right? Let's turn the customer into a security guard. And to me, that's the way to think about security. Right? And you sort of take a very holistic approach to security. And this is sort of my five-step process here. Understand the security problem and the stakeholders. Right? Understand what's going on and who's involved and who cares. Understand the trade-offs. Right? And they're both security and non-security trade-offs. Rarely is a security decision only about security. Security is just a piece of it. It's always about something else. Right? Align the economic incentives. If you don't do that, no solution will work. And to me, this is critical. If the economic incentives are not aligned, the problem will never get solved. If they are aligned, it'll just get solved by itself. Right? Capitalism will take over and it'll get solved. Just like credit card fraud. And then implement countermeasures. And this is easy if you've done the previous steps. And of course, technology changes things. But the thing about technology is it makes things different. Technology changes things. You must iterate this process. Right? Technology makes things faster, easier, cheaper, both for the good guys and the bad guys. Right? And that is real important to look at the technology and how it changes things. So that's the basic talk. I brought some stuff outside. Who here gets Cryptogram? Some of you do. Cryptogram, I have a flyer for it outside. Cryptogram is my monthly email newsletter. It's free. It comes out the 15th, so it just came out a few days ago. I like writing it. It's basically me explaining stuff that happens in the news and different security concepts and stories. Please, that's the URL. You know, feel free to sign up. I'm happy to send it to you. The list gets shared with nobody. People have asked, and the mailing list gets shared with nobody. That's just sort of a rule. So I sort of promise that. It's also available in blog form, if you like it every day. And this is my latest book. And it's Beyond Fear. And I have a copy here. What I did is I couldn't bring copy everybody, so I bought the extra thin version. This is a flyer for the book, and it's out front. So please grab one of those. And with that, I am happy to take questions about, I don't know, pretty much anything. And I'm surprisingly committed.
Thank you very much, Bruce.